Welcome to episode 32 of Gallifrey Public Radio. The Doctor is back, and we take the time to talk about the newest episode, The Bells of St. John.
But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Whovian name.
And Keir Hansen.
I'm holding up for catfights.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 32 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we hack into that oddly named network that just popped up, hop the nearest anti-grav bike, and bring you the ups and downs that are the eagerly awaited return of a new Who episode, The Bells of St. John. I am one of your hosts, Keir. With me, as always, it is Jay. Good evening, Jay.
How's it going?
And Melissa's in the house.
In the house. What's up, guys?
We are satisfied. Because we have finally gotten our serving of new Who to chew on.
Yay!
It's finally here.
It took a little while. God, it's like I was saying, it was like sitting in that restaurant, and you're seeing everybody else's plates go by. And like, oh, that looks good. Oh, I wonder what they're having. Oh, and then finally,
it's mine. Is it mine?
That looks like mine. I think I ordered fries. And then we finally got it. So we're going to be taking that apart in great detail because we've got a lot of things in there to chew on. And as I mentioned, the kind of the intro, ups and downs.
Yep.
We've got our praises. We also have our criticisms. So we'll give it a fair shake. We're just glad that it's back. But we've also got some really good news to chew on this week. All kinds of really good stuff, as we knew was going to happen. We get into the latter half of the season. We get closer and closer to the 50th, and news just starts coming at us fast and furious. So what do we got, Jay? What's some of the top of the heap here?
Well, let's start off with the small, tiny thing, a little bit of casting news for the 50th. Apparently, somebody named David Tennant and Billy Piper are going to be joining the cast. I don't know.
I think it's pronounced Tennant. I'm pretty sure it's Tennant. Yeah, he's French or something.
Minor thing. Yeah, minor thing. Yeah, so the Doctor and Rose will be returning. Well, the 10th Doctor, anyway, will be returning for the 50th anniversary special. Mm-hmm. This gets me both severely excited and kind of apprehensive at the same time.
How so?
This gets me so excited, you can't even – I'm like, the sounds that I'm producing are so far high that you can't hear them.
There are dogs in the neighborhood that are slowly
I mean, obviously, it's going to be so much fun to see them – see them back on the screen, but at the same time, it would be very easy to turn it into the, you know, David and Billy show and completely overshadow Matt Smith and Jenna Coleman. So I really hope that that's not the way they go. And I think that, you know, I think that Moffat has a strong enough grasp on what he's doing to be able to steer away from that. You know, you've got to give them at least like equal time or equal focus. But just because it's David Tennant and Billy Piper, you know, they're so popular and so many people love them and their characters that it would be very easy to let them run the show. So that's the only thing that makes me nervous about it.
But we don't know. I mean, literally, they're just now going into their second week of early production stages. And as far as we know, we have only heard read through notes and seen some promo shots from within their studios of Smith and Tennant, you know, Coleman and Piper and so forth.
Yeah.
So we don't know who else may be involved. As I was discussing this with somebody the other day, you've always got multiple locations on the shoots as well. So there may be additional footage with other cast members yet to be discussed that may be taking place elsewhere.
Yeah, and this kind of gets me excited because, you know, it was just a couple of weeks ago or maybe a month or so that we had, you know, Billy Piper saying, no, there's no way I'm doing it. Nobody's talked to me, nothing, you know. It was basically like a, you know, it's not happening kind of thing. And then here we get confirmation that she is actually in it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it makes me wonder, you know, who else has denied it that has been approached since then, or who was denying it just to cover it up?
You know? I really wanted to bring that up. So hopefully this means maybe John Barrowman or someone else who's denied being in it will end up part of this.
I don't know. I think Barrowman is actually out.
Yeah, I think the Barrowman book is closed.
the more I thought about it, you know, it's like he jumped up, said, yeah, no, they contacted me, this, that, and the other, and then, you know, relatively quickly was like, yeah, I'm not going to be in it. And it makes more sense in my head playing it out, saying, yes, he's actually not in it, than he's just trying to backpedal and cover it up. It just, that doesn't seem to fit.
I think he's backpedaling. I hope so.
I had a theory that because he was the first one to sort of break the silence in terms of who was involved in the early stages, because of his ego, because of his sort of self-aggrandizing behavior, that they bitch slapped him back down and said, sorry, you know, we're early enough that we can write you out right now.
Yeah, and I
wouldn't be surprised.
I'm kind of hoping that he's not actually in it, simply because John Barrowman is such a huge personality, not to mention ego, that if you put him on screen with a multitude of other people, he, you know, he chews the scenery and he just completely steamrolls everyone else. And when you've got the 50th anniversary going on, you know, you're going to have multiple characters. You're going to have a lot that you want to pay attention to. And I don't want all of that being overshadowed by John Barrowman.
It's not about Captain Jack.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, you got your spinoff show. Just, you know, enjoy that and let us have Doctor Who back.
I'm sorry, you were saying, Melissa?
No, I mean, I'm just, you know, that is your opinion. I want to be out there and say that I am a Captain Jack fan. And I mean, I'm a performer. I've been acting, like, you know, for many years. And John Barrowman just reminds me of so many other performers that I know. And, like, it's just the kind of person that I like. So you guys see it as ego. For me, I'm like, oh, like, that, you know, but for the grace of God, we could have been friends in some other world.
No, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love Captain Jack, and I think John Barrowman is a fantastic actor, and I love him to death. I just don't think him being in the 50th anniversary special would be the right fit. So that's all I'm saying.
I mean, it's definitely a valid opinion. I'm just saying, I hope that it's not true that he just, like, opened his mouth and got axed because of his own bragging or whatever, you know, but, like, as you guys are saying, but, like, it does seem that that's what happened.
Yeah, it kind of paints itself that way.
Yeah.
Something we do know is involved in the 50th, which was a kind of a weird development over the last couple of days, was a villain that we saw very little of in the past. The Zygons,
yes,
are back.
Zygons, we've really only seen them in one episode, right? Or one serial, I think.
Yeah, yeah, back with Tom Baker. Mm-hmm. And they were, as one of our friends described them, they look like the overcooked versions
of the Centaurans.
Of the Centaurans.
That's right.
if you left the potato in there a little too long and it started to wrinkle up, is what you'd end up with.
That's the first thing I thought as soon as I saw them. I was like, oh, that's a weird Centauran.
It's got valves on it. What's up with that?
That's where the armor sticks onto. Yeah.
Yeah. But they were actually cameo referenced in a couple of episodes. Well, cameoed in the Pandorica when we had the whole montage of every villain they could
fit. They were referenced
within the frame.
That's the only place I know them from, Pandorica.
Right. But they were mentioned in the Power of Three.
Yeah, they were under the Savoy Hotel, I believe.
And had been for some time, because they were systematically replacing the staff. They've been, again, you know, as Moffat is wont to do, he wants to try and you know, dip back in, at least at a reference point, if not be able to actually utilize as much of the classic elements that he's such a fanboy of as possible.
And, you know, the fact that he's including them in the 50th anniversary makes me think that reference to them in The Power of Three was more than just a one-off kind of like, hey, here, you know, let's mention this old villain. I'm thinking he was like, I'm going to throw them in here so that when they show up in the 50th, it makes sense.
Yeah, he drops breadcrumbs very systematically.
Oh, yeah, and so brilliantly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Some other interesting stuff that we had come across here. With regard to the 50th, now that we're getting into the production here, now that we're starting to get some confirmation of some actors and things, I'm starting to develop a theory, which I'll probably get to at the end of tonight's discussion, about how I think the tail end of this series is going to be stitching in to the 50th, because we do know, we do have confirmation from Moffat that the 50th will advance the storyline It is not encapsulated. It is not a standalone. It is not a, you know, it's not a Christmas episode, even though our Christmas episode this time was
not, yeah,
very, very much tied into the story as well. I think he's starting to break us out of that. Thankfully, you know, because it gets just as much viewership as any of the rest of the series on any given year. So why not just make it another episode a little more whimsical, maybe take some liberties that you wouldn't normally do, you know, break out of the primary arcs, but let it move the script along because we're following it just as closely.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So what else?
I know what else we got. Well, we also got a bit of spoilery information.
Right. Yes.
Not too terribly, but if you're really sensitive, go ahead and fast forward this. We'll say a minute starting now.
Okay.
All right. So anyone that's still with us here.
All right. We got 15 seconds per mention because basically they've, as a result of the BBC affiliate in South Africa, they got some details that leaked out about specifically the last four episodes that we're going to see this series. We all know the journey to the center of the TARDIS is going to give us some sort of interior stuff. Now they've sort of solidified the plot a little bit in saying that as a result of a crash, the TARDIS has been infiltrated by these salvagers, these ship salvagers, who are kind of, you know, like these scallywag sort of characters. Claire is lost within the TARDIS interior somewhere, and the Doctor has half an hour to track her down and solve the issue before the TARDIS itself destructs.
Yeah.
Big deal. Move on. Next one.
Well, that about took our whole minute there.
Yeah.
Crap. Shh, I can't do this. All right, all you spoilery people that are back, disappear for another 60 seconds. All right, I got to talk faster. Okay, Crimson Horror, which is our submarine episode that we know is going to involve the Ice Warriors.
No, that's Cold War.
Oh, that's Cold War. Sorry. Crimson Horror, that's our second period piece. Right, yes. Period piece. We're in Victorian Yorkshire. There are bodies to be found, and they are glowing, so there's going to be some supernatural element. It doesn't really help us much. Moving along. Nightmare in Silver, Neil Gaiman's episode. Okay, takes place within an abandoned funhouse, kind of, right?
Yes, yeah.
Theme park? Hedwig's World of Wonders. And then, obviously, there's a resurrection, as they refer to it, of these deadly silver monsters. So there's our Cybermen.
And then the last one here. Yeah, the last one is someone is kidnapping the Doctor's friends, leading him towards one place in all of time and space that he should never go.
And the new title, which is as of yet unconfirmed, but I'm telling you, it tells us so much. The Funeral of River Song.
Yeah. Okay.
So, pretend none of that ever happened.
But we don't want to talk about these now.
We're not. I got a little drooly as I was putting the link in there. Oh my God, this is stuff I'm not supposed to know.
Yeah, so, I mean, this could fit in with our look forward last week. I mean, nothing too terribly spoilery, but yeah. I know, I was looking at it feeling very, very, very guilty. Like, I shouldn't be reading this yet.
I don't know, because over the next couple of weeks, we'll probably get these details confirmed anyway. So it's not like we're giving away the whole story. We're just giving you information about, like, what we would get from a teaser.
Honestly. Well, I want to, you know, I'm going to get to this later, but last week when I started talking about the teasers that were released and you guys hadn't seen them, like, you know, that was bad on me. Like, I didn't know that you guys didn't know that. But I'm actually really glad that we didn't talk about them because they turned out to be so spoilery. The little, you know, they showed clips as teasers from the actual episode. Mm. And, oh my God, they turned out to be spoilery. So if someone is trying to stay away from spoilers, like, I fully commend them for staying away from this, you know, which we just tried to do with the descriptions or whatever. But a lot of stuff is getting released officially that is just very, you know, they want us to know a lot more than I thought they would.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether that's just because, I mean, they're writing these episodes with things happening on, you know, multiple levels. You know, you've got the blatant plot line, you've got some of the subtext because of the new companion, and then you've got some things that when you see them, you're thinking, oh, this must be a clue for something later. So things are happening on a lot of tiers, and maybe what they choose to put in these teaser trailers or that they decide to drop out there in some of the interviews or interspersed with some of the press junkets that they throw out there are only happening on the higher altitudes,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely many layers to these things.
Yeah. So, all right. Well,
Well,
hopefully we didn't ruin anybody's.
Wait, I just wanted to say, did you guys, the plot, or, you know, from everything that we've seen about Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, it reminds me so much of the episode of Firefly, where...
I think where
Mal and the Bounty Hunter are playing this, like, cat and mouse game on Serenity. Okay. Do you know what I'm talking about?
That's actually Objects in Space, yeah.
Okay.
Which was probably one of the best episodes.
Oh, it was. It was good. Anyway.
Yeah, so I've seen pictures, and just like this little bit that we talked about, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, I keep going back to that episode.
Hmm. And Jay, take me through this last piece that you found, because this is actually kind of interesting. It's interesting that he's decided to come forth and actually discuss this.
Yeah, so Stephen Moffat was discussing with the website Hollywood.com, and they were talking about the mystery of Clara, and Moffat has, right here he quotes, she's the insolvable mystery and the enigma. He's the one chasing after her. The Doctor wants to solve the mystery of Clara. You will uncover the mystery of Clara in the next 8 episodes. All will be made clear. You'll get your answer. Hmm. So he's confirming that we will know what the deal is with Clara by the end of Series 7.
Right.
So, you know, we talked about this a little bit last week, but that kind of leads me to believe that that's going to be the prominent thing throughout the series, and then the last episode will probably have the complete total answer, completely, you know, fleshed out, and it's going to lead us into the main plot for the 50th anniversary special, which
absolutely,
which is likely going to be the first question, and I would not be surprised. In fact, I'd be kind of disappointed if it weren't that Clara is an integral part in that. Like somehow she falls into it.
Yeah,
I think so. I think, you know, notice that he says all will be made clear. He in no way says that everything will be resolved.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
And
I think
all will be made clear, Clara, synonyms.
Oh, wow. She's stretching now.
No, I mean,
whoa.
Translate and then retranslate. Totally makes sense.
If you put it in the original Aramaic and then bring it back through the...
Let's see, RYCBAR 1, 2, 3. All right. So, episode 6 has fallen into our laps. And I'm still, as of yet, I'm going to hold back because we've got... Do we want to even bother doing any sort of a plot synopsis here? We're assuming that everyone has seen it at this point, at least once.
If you haven't seen it, stop right now, go watch the episode, come back, because we're just going to dissect this completely.
Yeah. Mm. Bells of St. John, you might have heard of it.
Which, in and of itself, very clever title right from the get-go.
Yeah, and Moffat's been doing that a little bit more often lately. You know, I think of The Power of Three being the most recent one where, you know, you're not really sure what it means. And granted, we got the resolution to this a lot sooner, but I thought it was very clever the way that he did that.
Right, right. Yeah, the days of the Doctor and the X, insert villain name here, are long gone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or the attack of the XYZ.
So the one thing that kind of surprised me though is when, or not surprised me, but caught me off guard was, you know, the monk comes up saying, you know, the bells of St. John are ringing, and they go and they find the Doctor and tell him that. They say the bells of St. John are ringing, and then he goes to the TARDIS and the phone's ringing and he acts all surprised. I'm like, wasn't that the whole reason you brought him down here? Yeah. Did he know this? It was kind of like, why are you acting surprised?
That's why I have in my notes, the bells of St. John are the bells of the TARDIS, right? Like, question mark. Because you're right.
Right. Hidden phone behind the St. John's ambulance panel. So, you know, cute little play there. I do like the fact that, you know, there's some quick exchanges among the monks there. You know, they refer to him as the mad monk. Well, he's not actually a monk.
Yeah.
They leave the mad part alone. That's a given. But he actually, you know, Smith kind of rocks the Franciscan robes pretty comfortably there. He actually pulled off that look pretty well.
This was 1207. The Franciscans didn't exist then.
Oh, okay. God, Catholic girls. Webs. So, back up a second. Just note that, or I should say, actually taking it progressively through the episode here. Then we get into our intro. Did you notice that they're still making tweaks and adjustments to the intro sequence?
I didn't know if they are, because I remember saying that it was longer than it really was, and it actually wasn't longer. So I was thinking, I think this is different, but I'm like, wait, it's like when I thought it was longer. You're just wrong.
Well, we mentioned last week that in the Christmas episode, we got rid of the tumbling through the vortex. That's pretty much gone. So now we're going through the sort of a nebula thing, which is kind of reminiscent of classic Who.
Yeah.
You know, and Smith's face sort of superimposed on it, which is very, very much a classic maneuver.
Yeah.
But I listened really closely to the intro theme, and they're bringing back a lot of those analog.
Yeah, the synthesizer sound, yeah.
Yep, which kind of says to me that they're slowly bringing us, sort of conditioning us or preparing us for that 50th kind of feel.
Hmm.
You know, that tip of the hat to the old and the new. So interesting that they're doing all that at once. I still don't like the whole idea of flying into the
TARDIS. That's something that's going to bother us throughout the entirety of this
cheesy wipe sequence. But yeah. All right. Well, overall feels on this thing. What was your overall take? Well, we'll get into some of the little tidbits and some of the little gifts that we got and some of the things that we had to chew on. But the episode itself, okay, the plot itself, the story, the storyline.
Mm.
What was your take on this?
Honestly, the feeling I got the whole time I was watching this, I kept thinking, this is the Idiot's Lantern done right. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything from, you know, stealing the people's soul to the face on the screen to
everybody, yeah,
even the motorbikes, even the motorbike coming out of the TARDIS. It's like, I mean, it was almost page for page out of the Idiot's Lantern, but this one actually worked. I don't like the Idiot's Lantern. I thought it was a bad episode, honestly. This one I actually liked. I think this one got it right. I'm not sure why, but this one was different.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, the acting. The actress, no one knows the name of the woman in the TV on the Idiot's Lantern, but this was actually like a known actress in this. Yes. I just want to throw that out there.
As Kislet, right. Yeah.
Yeah. But another thing is, I thought that this was very, very RTD. This was a very Russell Davies episode. It could have. Did you guys get that sense? Like with the opening, with the montage of the people and the Wi-Fi, whatever. Like I thought that this was very. For me, that's classic Who. Like I got into this with Ninth Doctor. Like this brought me back to that.
That actually reminded me a lot more of Sherlock than Doctor Who.
Oh, the quick cuts.
Yeah, the quick cuts and everything. Yeah, it was that. I started thinking more of Sherlock than Doctor Who at that point.
Mm. Well, yeah, insofar as, and that's kind of a trend, I'll back it up even farther, this trend you see in a lot of these sort of, get the intensity levels up quickly as far as BBC dramas go, because you saw a lot of that in Luther and Whitechapel and a bunch of the other drama series that they have going on, that they use that as a means to be able to say, here's a problem, and here's how it's affecting all the people, and they cut through all of these sequences, and the faster they do it, the more intense it seems like the situation is.
Yeah.
So it's one of their kind of running gimmicks at the moment. But Melissa, on the whole, what was your take on the plot and the entire storyline itself? Jay seems to be pretty happy with it.
Are you happy with it, Jay?
Well, like, I mean, the plot in and of itself I thought was a bit lackluster. I think it could have been a lot better, but I mean, that's something I've known going into this, that, you know, it was going to be about Clara more than it was about the story that they're going to put behind it. So the fact that the plot was less than I would have wanted, I was prepared for that. So it didn't really hit me all that hard.
Yeah, I feel the same way, because last time I think I talked about this, how all the intelligence that we got on the episode was like, oh, this is a right proper, you know, romp through London. And like, I was just like, that doesn't sound very appealing. And so when I we didn't have that high expectation, like I actually did enjoy the plot. And it, like I said, it was very, very RTD. I got literally scared at certain points. Like I always compare the show to Are You Afraid of the Dark? And God, all the new episode titles and stuff are just reinforcing that. But there were points at this where I was actually having that feeling of not only am I into the plot, and it's very there were funny moments and there were romantic moments and everything, but there were also kind of scary moments, which hasn't happened in a while. So I overall I liked that. It was like a ride through emotions.
Hmm. Okay. I got to say the thing that, you know, seemed the scariest out of this to me, and not for me, but the Spoonhead Doctor. I think that for kids, for younger kids that might be sitting down watching this, that's going to be a terrifying image. When his head starts to turn around and you realize that he's a Spoonhead. I mean, partly because, you know, this is the Doctor. As long as the Doctor is around, everything's going to be okay. You know, that's the way that we're conditioned to watch this show. And then all of a sudden you realize that the Doctor is the monster. I mean, some kids are going to get messed up by this.
Jenna Louise Coleman is what sold that, because from her point of view, whenever the Doctor's around is the time to be comforted and not worry about things. And she's like, Doctor, Doctor. And suddenly, like, it starts to dawn on her. And the acting right there, like, oh, my God, he's a Spoonhead. She was the one that sold it for me.
Yeah. Okay. So what did you think about it, Kier?
I'll take the devil's advocate road on this. As far as the plot itself, as far as the primary storyline, I thought it was kind of weak. The whole idea of the downloading premise was so reminiscent of being saved to the library. You know, and Spoonhead's reminded me of the library nodes. In fact, I think I actually like uttered that out loud as I was watching it. I'm like, oh, they're the freaking nodes. And they kept making this whole big deal about the fact that it was an irreversible process in the download, even though it was interrupted once when the Doctor did a little bit of his jiggery. And then at later times, by throwing around a lot of, you know, quickly rattled off, you know, techno jargon and a lot of spastic keyboard use. You notice how everybody was so very, very swish with their keyboards?
Yeah.
They were able to reverse this irreversible process twice. So... I kind of looked at that and said, yeah, okay. And I'll agree with you on that, Melissa. It did seem very RTD in that regard because of the fact that it had a kind of a whiz-bang quick solution to the end. Stick her in there and then force her to be let out along with everybody else. And there's your quick bow at the end tied up.
When I saw that, the first thing that popped into my head was the end of the Doctor Dances, you know, when he says, you know, just this once, everybody lives. And I'm like, yeah, it's not just that once. This happens way too often when it's just, you know, pop it out real quick, like, oh, let's just reverse the process and, hey, everybody's fine, nothing happened. Yeah.
The only people who actually suffer anything at the end of it all are the people who have been duped all along as being sort of inside the Matrix, so to speak. Up to this time, you know, and we've come to find out exactly how long they've been. Some of them have been stuck in there.
That was one of the more disturbing parts of the episode, I think.
That, absolutely. And so, which does really well for us to get us to sort of discuss the villain behind the curtain, not the obvious one that we think that we're dealing with all along, but the client involved in this.
So Kier called it right. We have 3 for 3 on Kier now. From now on, you are buying my lottery tickets, sir. That's all I'm saying.
And if anyone wants to start a pool about our podcast, like, we're telling you the odds right now.
So our great intelligence was behind this again, and very neatly covered its tracks at the conclusion, because by going back to factory resets, there's no knowledge. Are the only individuals who knew that the intelligence was still involved here have been wiped clean. There was no direct confrontation between the Doctor and the Great Intelligence, you know, through the screen. You know, we saw the face of our dear boy from the Christmas episode,
Dr. Simeon. I guess he's just kind of stolen his face now. Yeah, so
him because being, obviously,
so yeah, Richard Grant being cast in the series finale now makes a lot more sense.
Quite a bit. It's interesting. When I started to try and figure out how they intended to use this, because it was bothering me the fact that you know, as we were looking at the final 8 episodes here, we knew that the overwhelming mystery or the overwhelming tie that binds was going to be the Clara mystery, you know, which will now we know is going to be brought to some sort of a resolution or at least an explanation, if not a resolution, by you know, series finale. But we don't have something we've gotten used to, which is the threat that carries us through. Like, you know, the whole impossible astronaut, you know, and there are the silence and all these things that would give us something that we knew was our ongoing concern throughout, or at least across the span of a handful of episodes. everything we've been seeing for these eight look kind of standalone. You know, oh, okay, there's the Ice Warriors. Okay, there's the Spoonheads. Okay, here's this one. There's a period piece with ghosts. But it didn't look like it had that Stitch. I'm thinking this is going to be our Stitch.
Yeah, it's, I mean, so if we look at the episodes we got coming up, you know, the Rings of Akkaten, I don't think he's going to be involved there. You know, that'll be a standalone thing. I don't really see him being involved or it being involved in the, you know, in a Russian submarine in 1983. It could be something like he's the one that brought the Ice Warriors back. So, I mean, it could happen, but I don't see the Great Intelligence being a huge part of the story. He's just going to be just something that threads through the next few episodes to get us to the series finale.
Right. I may be more present in the present day or future episodes.
Yeah. I mean, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, I could see the Great Intelligence being the thing that causes the conflict there. There's a couple of them I can see where they could fit it in very nicely and have it play a prominent role. But then there's some of them where it's like, if it's going to be involved at all, it's not going to be, you know, very much.
Right. I think I did find out, I mean, Moffat's been sitting on this idea for a while. He's been thinking about the use of the Great Intelligence for some time, because it was actually back when he handed the pen to Neil Gaiman to write The Doctor's Wife. Their original intent, Gaiman's original intent, was to use the Great Intelligence as the primary plot line for that episode.
So play the role of House, basically?
Essentially, yeah. Or it might have been in some sort of an earlier iteration. The plot might have been entirely different, but he wanted that to be kind of the crux of it. And Moffat stepped in and said, no, I want to use this later, and pulled it out of his hands. Huh. So interesting that he's been kind of brooding. Well, maybe not brooding, but at least considering that for some time, and might have been just looking for exactly thinking of the right opportunity to use it. Because, I mean, you're dealing with an entity that's older than the universe itself, unknown its levels of power, and how long it's been manipulating the individuals and the civilizations around the Doctor. And aside from the Doctor and maybe the Brig, it's really unknown up to this point. I mean, the Doctor's only been exposed to it, you know, once or twice. And doesn't even really understand the full extent of it. In fact, the intelligence has actually lambasted him in the past, saying, you know, like referring to him as being puny minded and things of that sort in terms of his overall knowledge of things. So this could be a formidable villain, if it becomes what I think it could, which could be, I mean, think about how far this goes back. Because this, I think, could be something that gets us, you know, it is somehow involved with the Clara mystery and then propels us into the 50th, which would be an explanation as to why you need multiple iterations of the Doctor's regenerations, because you're going back into the past and all the occurrences where the intelligence has made itself known or has been tweaking things going on to try and capture or spell the demise of our Doctor.
Yeah.
That's my theory. So, but pulling back to the episode, we've got some Clara time.
Yeah,
we get to see how they interact now on present day at their pace.
Yeah, and I thought that this would have been a great introduction to Clara if it had been our first. The fact that we've seen her in Dalek form, the fact that we've seen her in, you know, Victorian era. Seeing her now in the, you know, square one kind of phase, it just seemed like a letdown almost. I mean, it may be that that's how it's supposed to be, and when we look back on it later on, we'll see how it fits. But after seeing her in these first two iterations where she was awesome, she seemed kind of bland compared to those two. I mean, she was still awesome, but just comparing her to those first two introductions, it just seemed kind of like, you're supposed to be more awesome than this. Get it together. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you guys watched it on BBC America, but there was a commercial on what I watched. I watched it on Yeah, no. I DVR'd it both times. Okay, so yeah, I watched it on BBC America twice. And there was a commercial that was like a behind Doctor Who or whatever. And Jenna Louise Coleman was giving an interview saying Clara is an ordinary girl living in London in present day. And it struck me as so odd because the commercial came on at a point where we hadn't really seen, that she really was, I was kind of hoping that she wasn't going to be ordinary. And it struck me as so odd that she would say that, like, that's her character, that she's so ordinary. And that's, something worth noting because Clara, we've seen before, like, is completely not ordinary. So this iteration of her, which it seems is the one that's going to travel with him, we're still not entirely clear on that, is like the ordinary version of this girl who died twice.
Yeah.
Well, she still does have some of those elements which have caught us interested in terms of, her ability to kind of roll with everything she's been exposed to. So you're an alien, yeah? Yeah, I am. Okay. And it kind of goes with it.
Yeah, she's fine with it, yeah.
That idea of being curious but fearless as you mentioned, it's a little different this time around. She starts to take some of those kind of classic responses. She does throw the line in there about the bigger on the inside and things this time when she first enters the TARDIS. And so it's interesting, some of the subtleties in the way each iteration has behaved.
So can we just say real quick, I mean, the shot that they did there, I know it's not all one shot, but they did a very excellent job of editing it to look that way where, they're outside of the TARDIS and then they run in and you follow them into the TARDIS and then, they're running around the console, coming back, and then run back out the door onto the plane. And it was just, it looked like one shot. I mean, if you look closely enough, you can tell, okay, there's the break and there's the other one. But just the way they did that, it was really awesome. I loved the camera work in this episode. I thought the camera work in it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Another thing is, though, that's again, her being ordinary, because we've seen her enter the TARDIS before, and she says something that no person in however many dozens have been in there has said. It was smaller on the outside. And, that was an extraordinary thing for her to do. And now this time, she was just like everyone else, where, oh, my God, it's bigger on the inside. Did you guys catch that?
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that you kind of had to. That's the staple line. You have to get that with new companions. So, yes, it was clever the way they did it originally, but,
they didn't have to do it again at all, my point.
I don't begrudge Moffat the, throwing that in there. It almost would have seemed weird. it would have seemed, this version of Clara hadn't been in the TARDIS yet, so if she hadn't reacted to it, it would have been weird.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I am glad that they did not turn her into the South Park Kenny. So y'all were wrong. She did not die.
Technically,
she's not the Rory of this show, because Rory is already the Rory of this show.
Technically, she did die again, because she did get upgraded or uploaded to the servers, and her body was dead. And, once they reversed it, you saw her take a breath again, and that's when the doctor kind of relaxed. She was dead, because they set it up front. When you get uploaded, you die.
They said within 24 hours you die.
Yep.
No. He was saying that you die for about 24 hours, or it was something like that, where you're dead for a little bit, and then you might come back later, but you're not you. That's what I got out of it. But I'm saying technically she died again. Nobody can.
You still might be right, but yeah.
It wasn't full-blown, dead, gone, let's find another version of her, but she died. I'm saying it.
What if that is another version of her now? We go to the second episode, and it's like a completely different Clara. Because I could see that happening. This ended with her saying, come to me tomorrow, and I'll come with you. Mm. What if he goes to her tomorrow, and like all this stuff has happened?
And she's died.
Right.
In her sleep, in the middle of the night.
I really wouldn't put it past them.
That would be hilarious.
Every time we're seeing her, though, we're getting a little bit more of her coming around to meet the other iterations. This time around, she's a nanny again. Or becomes a nanny at some point. By the end of this episode, she's got... as a result of her download, she's got this greater intelligence and understanding of computers. Oswin was a computer whiz.
Yeah.
who hacked into the Daleks' mainframe.
So we're starting to see where the other iterations kind of fed into it.
So the question is, but which order are we headed?
Yeah.
Are they overlapping? Are they sequential? Are they compounding? You know, how does that all play out? And what set her, whatever she is, she is like the Starbuck at this point now. The what was Starbuck? Well, one is clear. You know, what is the force that set that into motion? Whatever she is, what put her out there and for what purpose?
She's the Jaggeroth from City of Death. She's just all over the place.
Exactly. Well, that's actually a good, you know, what if she is like that?
Yeah. Well, there was one of our listeners and friends of ours, Shooter, was talking to me the other day. He sent me a couple text messages, pretty long-winded ones. When Shooter finally gets his, because of his job, he can't really text or communicate much during the day. So as soon as he gets out, he has all these head full of thoughts that he decides to spill out. And so he sent me long text messages that basically summed up to, all right, we don't know what Clara is. The Doctor doesn't know what Clara is. One of the fascinating things that we enjoy about this is the fact that the Doctor is bothered by the mystery. It nags at him, you know, it sticks in his teeth and he has to figure it out. And every time he gets some sort of a reminder, and we're sort of seeing this through his eyes, you know, when she plays out the spelling of the password or run you clever boy and remember and those things, or the first time she says Doctor Who and he makes her repeat it three times because he loves it.
Yeah.
These are him fascinated by what she is and what he doesn't know about her, right? We're kind of in agreement on that.
Yeah.
Well, Shooter's theory is he's keeping her very close. He's being extremely protective of her, obviously. Maybe more so in its immediacy or the quickness of his reactions than he has with other companions of late. But his question is he doing that because he genuinely like cares for her so much, this girl that he's only spent a matter of a handful of days with all of the iterations that we've seen combined? Or was he back there, you know, in the 13th century, you know, locked away as a recluse in a monastery, brooding over this and painting pictures and doing all this research because he doesn't know what she is and doesn't trust her and sees her as a potentially villainous entity? So the whole adage of keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer.
I can see where that could be a possibility. I get the impression more that he feels about her the same way she does about him. He's just fascinated. This is someone that he can't figure out, and that's new to him. That's something that just intrigues him. You know, if you've seen the prequel for this episode, you know, he seems really upset that he can't find her. Not stressed out that there's this potential villain on the loose that he can't track down, but, you know, very sad and despondent that he can't track down his friend. So that kind of, if you're just going off the show itself, just the standard episodes, yeah, it's possible that could be the case. But with that prequel thrown in there, it seems really, really unlikely to me.
Mm. Well, I mean, I've got my reasons for thinking otherwise, too. It's just the way that he had worked this through is kind of interesting. I mean,
there's definitely a basis there for thinking that.
Yeah.
I mean, would love if that's actually where it goes, but I just don't think it is going to be where it goes.
I'm wondering whether it might be a sleeper agent kind of thing, where maybe there's some credibility to this, but she doesn't even realize that she is endearing herself so quickly to him because she's systematically, you know, programmed or whatever to be that way.
Well, that could work because that's how she really was in Asylum of the Daleks. Mm-hmm. But she, you know, there was something in her then that was able to overcome the Dalek part that wanted to destroy the Doctor. Right. So I wonder, you know, they could go with this where that, you know, that continues where, you know, there's part of her that wants to save him. Or, you know, it could be just straight up she's his enemy and this turns out to be a completely different situation than what we're expecting.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, if this is a sort of an idea, you know, again, I'm gonna put a little bit of a coin down on the great intelligence idea. If this is something that it's been orchestrating by putting these iterations of this perfect companion out there, it's been studying the Doctor for a while. It knows, you know, the affinity that he has for humanity and the lengths that he'll go to keep them safe. So if he keeps putting one out there that has been genetically engineered to be this great you know, companion and counterpoint for him, but is slowly leading him towards the, you know, towards his own ruin. You know, one of the best ways to be able to take down your enemy is to have them do so by their own hand. So since the intelligence doesn't have a corporeal form and it has to be manipulative, you know, there you go. Use its intelligence to design the perfect weapon for which the doctor uses to destroy himself.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's getting kind of deep, but, you know, this is Moffat. He could do it.
Yeah, definitely.
So speaking of mysteries and speaking of Clara, we've got all kinds of little things that were handed to us for us to say, oh, God, well, that's got to mean something.
Yeah.
And now the question becomes, how many of them are valid? How many of them are red herrings? And for the ones that are valid, what the hell do they mean?
All right, so let's talk first, if you guys don't mind, about the book. So
yeah.
Clara is the nanny of these children, and the little girl has this book called Summer Falls by Amelia Williams, first of all. And second of all, it says, well, I wrote Sherlock and John are on the cover because it totally looks like them. but also, she has this quote, 11's the best yet, you'll cry your eyes about. Talking about the chapters, and you know, she's only on chapter 10. Well, you gotta wait till 11. So clearly they're talking about the 11th Doctor and stuff. Do you guys think this is just a red herring? This is just like a, you know, a high five to us, or
I think it was just a bit of fan wink. I think it was the same thing as, you know, in Asylum of the Daleks, when the Doctor's like, on a scale of 1 to 10, 11. You know, it was just one of those little things. Like, yeah, it's a meta joke that he loves to throw in there. I don't think there's any relevance to it.
Well, what about the you'll cry your eyes out? Because we haven't really cried our eyes out too much with
what do you
Eleven.
Mean?
Or, well,
look at the angels take Manhattan.
Yeah, you didn't soul.
God, well, you heartless witch.
It's not that I didn't cry then. It's that it would be very arrogant of Moffat to reference it so soon as, like, oh, you'll cry. Like, it's only been a few months. Like, your legacy is not defined yet.
Well, okay. No, I understand. But I mean, again, I think to a certain degree, some of this is fan fluff. Some of it is just meta humor that he loves to utilize. And some of it is just a matter of saying that, you know, he likes the holistic approach to these things. He likes to be able to say, you know, and give us hints to the interconnectedness of all these things, or the fact that Amelia Williams is the author of the book that Clara finds and things of that sort. Those are those little stitches that make us as a viewer go, oh, that's cool.
So do you think, though, that that's the Amelia Williams?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because where was it? I think it was in the PS, the letter that Rory wrote to his dad, that he makes reference to the fact that Amy started writing children's books.
So, oh, okay. I don't remember. So, I mean, I was thinking actually more when she published River's book. So, like, I knew she was a publisher. I didn't know if she wrote, but I didn't remember that. From
one of her many jobs. She hasn't been able to hold a job down very well over the years.
Seriously, yeah. Amy.
Model, traveling agent, Kissogram. Yeah, no. She's run the mill, yeah.
So, but then, all right, well, with regards to books, we've got her adventure book, you know, her 101 Places book, which on the interior, you know, when she, you know, signed her Ex Libris inside the cover and started putting down her ages as she goes on through her years, there are numbers, correct me if I'm wrong, two numbers.
16 missing. And 23 are skipped. Right. So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the things I picked up on, and that When I watch the episode for the first time, I try not to dig too far into it. I'm just like, I want to sit here and mindlessly enjoy this episode. Then I'll go back and pick it apart. But that was something that jumped out at me right away. Was there's two numbers missing there. Something is going on here.
Okay, so the way that I thought of it was because she in the Christmas episode, there was the gravestone that said Clara Osmond Oswald, and she died at age 26. So the book was written at 24. So I'm like, is she really 24 here or 26? Like, you know, has she skipped it again? But I have to point out 16 and 23 are two of the numbers from Lost, and I really hope that this is a Lost reference because those numbers jump out at me like nothing. And I, like you said, like, you know, you want to watch that first episode and just go through it, but I was like, oh my God, 16, 23, oh my God.
And we've reached the Melissa numerology portion of our program.
You don't understand. These
She's
numbers
start
dominate.
Tattooing these things in her forehead and sitting in a small cell.
Maybe not forehead, but like back of the neck, wrist. Like, you never want to forget. No, seriously though, like I would love if this is actually meant to be a Lost reference. I don't think so, but I do see these numbers everywhere.
I was seeing it more as, you know, these are points within her personal timeline where she, for whatever reason, was not there at those 2 years to write her name into the book.
There's that possibility, or it's simply the fact that, you know, she just didn't write it down. She didn't – something happened in her life that she didn't get back to that book and didn't think about writing her age down. You know, it could be something very simple like, you know, my mom died and I was kind of out of it and never – you know, didn't pick it up until the following year or, you know, something like that where it could be just a very simple thing where she just skipped it. Or what's I think everyone seems to think and which I find to be more likely is, like you said, something happened and she was not present to do so.
Right. Well, I don't think we're going to have to wait too long for that one because we're already starting to between that and the leaf mystery within the book.
Yeah.
I believe we're going to start getting some answers to that just within the next episode or two, according to some of the, you know, the screen captures and early shots. So that leaf.
There's some theory going around that that's an episode or a reference to the podcast of Radio Free Scarrow. Granted, it was perpetuated by the guys from Radio Free Scarrow, but hey, it's out there. yeah. So there's not a lot to go on. I mean, it's a Canadian reference, maybe. Yeah, all we know is that there's a leaf and she said it's page one.
My knee-jerk reaction to that was I saw it and said, oh, okay, well, all books begin from paper pulp, begin from a tree. So there's page one. And she was just sort of looking at it as sort of a reference to seeing things on a long view.
Does she really do that, though?
I think what it means is that it's page one because it's the most important to her. There's something about that leaf, something that it symbolizes that is the primary thing. You know, this is the thing that is above everything else in this book. That is why it's page one.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, another thing is, though, the doctor licked the leaf and somehow gleaned some data from that. And later when she says that's page one, he gets this look on his face like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Did you guys see that? So like I think he knows what she meant by that. I have no idea.
I see when I saw that smirk, because she says that on her way out the TARDIS door. Mm-hmm. After saying, you know, I'll be back tomorrow for you. That smirk is just because, again, it feeds into his, you know, it's another mysterious element. And it's like the game is afoot. You know, it's something else that he has to figure out. I didn't really take it that much farther. I definitely did not connect that with the fact that he licks and smells everything that he comes into contact with. No, the air doesn't taste right. It's metallic. There's something different. I don't know. I do know, for those of you who have not seen, because obviously as we're recording this now, we're coming close to the next upcoming episode for the Rings of Akkadin that we'll see on Saturday. And I know that in some of the early scenes, some of the quick promo shots that they put out there have her holding up that leaf.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah.
Something's up.
Yeah.
And that's as far as I know. I mean, that's as far as I've taken. I've seen two different angles of a shot. One with her sort of holding it as they're sort of on the move somewhere, and one with her standing there and holding it at arm's length out in front of her as if it's, you know, this representative object.
And that's the first thing I thought. As soon as I saw it, I was like, that's the leaf from the poster of Rings of Akkadin. So, yeah, I know it's going to come into play very, very soon. I think that's going to be the thing that kind of leads into the next episode. You know, and there might be something that they kind of do with that, like where, you know, the end of this episode ties very nicely into the beginning of this one, so.
And one of the other little tidbits that we had was the fact that, you know, in the early point in the episode, as she's trying to figure out the password for the household Wi-Fi, it's that RYCBAR, and mm-hmm. her way of sort of working out how to remember, because she says as the girl rattles off, she's like, oh, how am I supposed to remember that thing? Okay, well, run, you clever boy, and it's just a passing thought. It's just
right,
you know, taking through the letters, but the fact that she uses that phrase, the phrase,
yeah.
So what's going on? Why does she have this recurrent knowledge that she doesn't even realize that she is tapping into?
Well, I mean, the question is where are we in her timeline?
Mm.
You know, is this the first occurrence of the phrase? Is this, you know, something she's heard before and just happened to coincide? Is this, you know, the third time that it's actually come up? You know, we don't know where we are in her timeline, so it's hard to say how relevant it is that she mentions it here.
Mm. That's a good point.
Hey, let me throw something completely sidelong at you. By the way, new costume change for the Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
Going with a 3/4 length coat.
Did you guys think that's the second Doctor's bow tie that he put on? It was all worn looking. Worn. Yeah.
I think it was just the purple and the gold, because that's the combination of your red and blue. So now it's very much kind of a, you know, I'm on a clear line here. So, and it also uses when he was in his broody phase during the Christmas episode.
It bothered me though that he opened it up and it was like bow tie already. It wasn't like. It made me think, is it a clip on? Is he wearing a clip on bow tie? Because that is not cool. Clip ons are not cool.
Mm. When he was digging through all of his old stuff and he pulled out the brown coat, I didn't notice really quickly. Was that his old tweed coat?
Yeah, it was the tweed coat, yeah.
This is what I was talking about last week. Again, this is like a spoiler that they released a while ago that I think was a little too spoilery that they shouldn't have shown. But when I first saw that, I thought it was the 10th Doctor's coat, so I was like, holy crap. Yeah. And then I was like, it's pretty short. That was his tweed coat that he used to wear, yeah.
For a split second, I thought he pulled Tennant's trench coat out.
Yeah, that was the first impression I got when you first see it, because it's really not a clear shot. But then he kind of holds it up, and you see it is short, and so he's like, that's him saying, do I want to go back to the tweed, or do I want to try something new?
Yeah.
He should have totally pulled out Peter Davidson's coat.
Oh, that would have been great.
That nasty with the red stripe and the... Oh.
And have like a wilted piece of celery still stuck to it.
It's icky looking piece of compost.
I've actually, on my notes here, I've got it saying, you know, dig in the new long coat. And then a couple lines later, seriously, I love the coat.
Yeah, I think it suits him a lot better.
Oh, yeah. I want Tennant's long coat, but this would be a very close second for my Doctor Who cosplays. Yeah.
He still does have his Austin Powers boots on, so we'll give him that. And I thought we had noted at some point that they were changing, that they had changed the flooring in the TARDIS interior to get away from the glass or the plexi that they'd used before. And I had commented, okay, now he's no longer going to be doing that stupid sliding around the console all the time. He's still doing it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's Matt Smith. It's not the floor. I mean, you can put grip tape down there and somehow he'll manage to slide across it.
Actually, it levitates. All right.
I know we kind of strayed, but let's go back to talking about the mysteries. So when Clara is on the phone and, you know, the Doctor's like, where'd you get this number? And she says, the woman in the shop.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh.
All right. I'm calling it right now. It's one of two people. And
okay. I can't wait to hear this, because a very good friend of ours threw two names out there. And
I have a name too, and I know you're going to say it. Yeah.
Everybody write it down your hand. On the count of three, we share it.
All right. Is it going to be River, or is it going to be Rose?
Oh,
Not the name I was thinking of.
Go on, Melissa. Who'd you have?
Sally Sparrow.
Thank you.
the woman in the shop. Yeah.
Yeah. Could have been the girl in the DVD shop.
Yeah, but that was a bookshop. Well, they changed it to a bookshop.
DVD shop.
That's what it was originally, but
there
at the
no
end,
DVD
it was
shops anymore.
It was books.
It was like books and rare DVDs. Yeah.
So yeah. I don't see that being somewhere you go to get tech help. But
she's so bad at tech that that's where she goes. Like,
Sally was always going to be a continued friend of the Doctor. She wanted to be there for him to help in any way possible later on.
Yeah, but where would she have gotten the number from, though? Yeah, she never had access to it. She never contacted him again. It was just she gave him the folder before he ever knew her. So I don't see that one happening.
Besides Rose, though, I can't think of any other girls in shops that we've seen. Nope. I mean, like, you know, characters, because now I'm immediately thinking of the new New Earth where they sold drugs on the street and stuff. Like, but
I'm saying it's either going to be Rose or it's going to be River, and I can't decide which one. I think River is more likely, but now that we know that Rose is going to be in the 50th, I'm thinking that's very, very possible. So I'm kind of 50-50. I'm not sure which one I want to put my quarter on yet.
Okay. Fair enough. But that is an excellent question. That's another one of those ones where it could be completely useless information, and it could matter, you know, absolute frack all.
I think they gave it just a little bit too much time for it to be a throwaway thing. It's if she had just said, no, the woman in the shop gave it to me, and the doctor's like, what? You know, and then they moved on, yes, then it could be a throwaway. But the fact that she went back and said, no, she said it was the best one in the universe, I'm like, that makes me think that they have to go back to it. They spent just a little bit too much time explaining it for it to be a throwaway line.
Okay. Well, then the only other thing I wanted to kind of get your takes on was, now that we've seen past, future, well, let's say future in right order. We've seen future, past, and now present day Clara, and the way that she interacts with Eleven. What do we think about the whole flirting bit?
It was a little bit too predominant at times for me, where it was like, seriously, tone it down. But the fact that it was only verbal, like it was only mentioned and nothing ever really came close to it, kind of gave me hope that they're going to steer away from it.
Okay. I actually liked the flirting, because I think it was not about the dynamic of the Doctor and Clara, but more of Clara's defense mechanism of like how she's going to deal with him. You know what I mean? Like, I think if it really said something about their relationship, I'd be like, oh, come on, not like, you know, not another companion to be a romantic interest. But like, I think it's actually telling us something about her as a person, which I like.
It was done very well. I think that the only reason why it stuck out to me so strongly was because I am so apprehensive about it. If I hadn't been waiting for it and dreading it, I don't think I would have noticed it as much.
At any point where it started to get most intense, you know, the whole snog box discussion and all those things, the only thing that kept going through the back of my head was, hi, remember River, your wife?
Yeah, yeah.
Over and over and over and
over. Well, I mean, depending on their timelines, that, you know, they, you know, how can he have a wife at all? He just has wives all at once. Yeah. Like, you know, timey-wimey.
Yeah, from now on, though, the TARDIS is totally getting nicknamed Snogbox.
Yeah, it's happening.
The takeaway of this is Snogbox is a great name for a TARDIS, as is mobile phone, which is surprisingly accurate description.
Yes, I like the mobile phone.
Yeah.
I thought that was funny.
It was.
Surprisingly accurate, yeah. I don't know. I'm hoping that the closeness, or the reason why the flirting interplay works well, is because, again, it's another one of those things where Smith is at his best when he's rattled or he's forced to make, you know, quick decisions and sort of impulse reactions, and the flirting throws him. So it leads to that. She becomes a catalyst for a more proactive rather than reactive doctor, which I think is a positive one for him particularly.
Right.
That's a great, you know what, that's actually a great way of putting it, because I really loved when he's getting coffee and he's like, hey, shut up. Like, you can't think of what to say to her. He just says, exactly. Shut up. Like, I really like Matt Smith there. You're right. Like, it brings out that thing in him.
So, but I'm hoping that that one of the Coleman's discussions in the interview is about referring to it as a not so much flirty as it is a very good kind of symbiotic brother sister relationship, and I hope that's what this kind of emerges into over the course of time, so that they are very close and they could be sort of seen as a couple. If you didn't know, I mean, you've seen siblings out there that are just really close, and if you didn't know they were siblings, you'd think, oh, they're a cute couple, because they kind of riff off of one another and they complete each other's sentences because they know each other that well.
Yeah.
But they just happen to be siblings. You just didn't know that. And it makes the whole thing weird.
Speaking of, Viserys Targaryen was in Family of Blood. I just want to throw that out there.
talking about incest, you got to think of Game of Thrones and a lot of people. back to, wait, what was I going to say? Oh, I actually really like their interaction, because this is the first episode where we've seen Clara and the Doctor, because with the Christmas episode, yes, like, she was a proper companion, like, it was the two of them doing their thing together, but there's just something about, you know, the season has started up, and she's a modern day person and all that stuff. Like, so we're actually seeing their relationship. So, like, yeah, we can talk about the flirty thing, but I think it really is going to go into that, like, kind of brother and sister thing. And did you guys, when they're on the plane, she screams, "Please tell me what is happening." And I can't do it the way that she does, but it sounded just like Karen Gillan. She sounded just like Amy.
I thought that too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and Jenna Louise Coleman has said she didn't watch the show before this. So for her research as an actor, she's been watching the Amy and Rory years.
Mm-hmm.
So for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, did anyone else catch that when they're on the plane, the doctor, you know, when he's running through his explanation really quick, he says that he's 1,000 years old. And as soon as he said that, the first thing I thought was, wait, in a town called Mercy, he said he was 1,300 years old now.
Yeah, so, I had this discussion too, and I said it was just a matter of he summarized the sake of getting through this traumatic situation with a crashing plane.
That's what I was thinking too. That's what I was thinking too. But I mean, he has jumped around quite a bit in, you know, what he's saying his age is, and here's a spinoff theory: all this stuff with Clara happened in those gaps between where he saw Amy and Rory.
I can completely see that.
Because, I mean, he's jumping around, you know, 100, 200 years at a time. Who's to say he didn't have entire adventures with Clara during that? It's not going to pan out. I really think that that's not the way that they're going to go. But, you know, let's just go ahead and throw it out there and throw some people on the internet into an uproar.
Yeah, should Amy be jealous? Give us your feedback.
You were cheating on Amy with Clara. Dang. Do you guys think that it's relevant that the great intelligence once again targeted a kid?
I think that's just most easily manipulable.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was thinking too. It's just something I was like, this is two times in a row that, you know, it's picked a kid, and I mean, that was creepy as all hell.
It's just, it made me sad. I was like, ooh.
It's just the fact that it robbed her of you know, potentially life. 50 years of, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, you can think about it, the intelligence is so outrageously old that, you know, this is the lifespan of a human is a blip. And if it knows that if it's going to have to manipulate one, then it's easiest to hit it at the early point of the blip than the later point in the blip. It's still a blip. So might as well make its job easier and hit them when they're most malleable.
And that was just like when that happened, I was like, oh, man, that is messed up. Because I've said that before. That's one thing I can't stand is violence or, you know, harm to kids in TV. I mean, that bothers me on a visceral level. And when that happened, I was just kind of like, oh, man, I'm going to – oh, no.
Yeah. So, well, we've had some things to appreciate, some things to dismiss as, okay, well, it is what it is. And all in all, I think we got a solid episode worth of things to ponder. Mm-hmm. You know, going into the episodes to follow, it's going to be interesting to see whether or not with these little loose threads that they're starting to put in front of us that we feel so inclined to tug on and completely unravel, whether or not they're going to be coming at us week to week to week. You know, with the Rings of Cotton coming up next week, I personally don't really know a whole lot about our core plot to this episode.
Right.
Watch the little scenes from the next that they gave to us and said, okay, it doesn't really help me with much of anything. It's a lot of screaming and running around and explosions and something that looks like the Sycorax. I don't know.
It kind of seemed like a cross between like the episode with the Sycorax and then the Escape from Pompeii episode or whatever it was called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. But steeped with Egyptian mythology in this time around.
Yeah.
Or at least that feel.
That's the reference we get.
So, I don't know. I'm pleased with the fact that even though I wasn't a big fan of the episode itself, I was very pleased with what they've done to sort of feed our cravings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a – I think all in all, it was a decent episode. I mean, we got jokes about Twitter. We got Jammy Dodgers. We got, you know, Clara throwing out her – where she gets the Oswin from. So, you know, it was
Wait. Which, by the way, so you guys are Keir Hanwin Hansen and Jay Witt. Just – she gets Oswin from Oswald for the win. And
so I get Weewin?
Yeah.
Women.
Yep.
All right.
I don't know what to pull away from this one.
I think at this point we just pull away the fact that Doctor Who was back.
Yay. Okay, wait, but besides what we pull away from it, do you guys have any theories on Clara? Do we want to get into that? And then before we wrap up, like, do we have anything that we're, you know, is anything skewing one way or the other with you guys? Because it's not with me.
Not well, really.
Just what I was expressing earlier, that I think there's an underlying thread here with the great intelligence that and I'm really going to start to put some thought towards this idea of this sleeper agent, because that's something that has not been other than what they did with cultivating River to be the perfect weapon. This would be a little bit, it'd be a similar vein, but it'd be a little bit different approach, throwing multiple copies, you know, iterations. Okay, that one didn't work. Oh, we have to tweak it. Send another one out. That didn't work. Okay, we'll go back and we'll hit him back in the 1600s. I'll throw that one. That didn't work. Okay, we'll hit him in the future. We'll throw him one that's a Dalek. No, that didn't work.
Yeah.
I think that it's got some merit to it, and I'm just going to have to see whether or not over the next episode or two I get anything more that I can put on that side of the scale and say, all right, no, that's valid. In which case it would make sense, because when I was discussing earlier about the fact that our friend here was saying that, well, maybe she's an enemy all along and the doctor doesn't trust her. Well, I think you hit it on the head. Take that Jammy Dodger scene, mm-hmm. You know, where she's laying there unconscious. He could just stay by her side, keep an eye on her, you know, nurse her as much as necessary until she wakes. But he just set everything perfect. He cared so much, you know, to make this perfect little situation, this perfect little waking moment for her, that the whole idea of keeping your friends close and your enemies closer kind of falls apart at that point.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that she couldn't potentially be dangerous to him for him.
Oh, yeah.
And just not know it.
Yeah, she could definitely turn out to be a villain. I just don't know if – I don't think that the doctor sees her that way. So, I mean,
I don't know about a villain so much as a
– a danger. Yeah.
A danger.
A Sharon Valeri kind of situation. You know, like, if anything, I think that this scene proves that neither of them is expecting her to be this. So if she is a sleeper agent or whatever, like, she really doesn't know it is the takeaway.
Yeah. Well, wait, Melissa, you're saying a sleeper agent that doesn't know that they're an agent?
I need extra exposition to explain what I'm saying.
All right. Well, we did get – we also got some a question from listener Badgerspoon asking if we think that the Gallifreyan writing up on the time rotor means anything.
Mm. I looked at some stills that I captured from it, and started to try to take that apart. I've tried to teach myself, you know, some crude Gallifreyan, circular character. If you look closely at some of them, they're actually tipped so that you're not looking at the character straight on. They're sort of on an axis, and you're seeing kind of like a gyroscope that's starting to turn away from you, which would defeat the whole point of being able to read them. So I think it may just be design.
Yeah, it's – I personally think that it's – they – if they wanted to make it a message, if they wanted to make it relevant, they would have to come up with a meaning for the language or a way that the language was actually written or something like that, some way to explain the language. And I don't think that that's something they're willing to do at this point. I think it's just purely like – you know, people recognize it as Gallifreyan. We, you know, the TARDIS is from Gallifrey, so let's, you know, give it a bit of the home flavor.
Mm-hmm. I think they're just not showing enough of the characters to even be readable, even if they did have in mind what it was supposed to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, this isn't a fringe kind of, you know, throw them a character before each commercial break kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, I think that aside from the maybe a couple things popping up on the monitor screens or something, the only time we've really seen the Circular Gallifreyan has been on the Doctor's crib, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so
yep. Well, and that was obviously those characters have been unchanged. Those are legitimately, like, if you take apart the alphanumerics of the Gallifreyan language as it's been slowly decoded by the fan base out there over the course of the decades, and they've done an excellent job of actually being able to figure out or put together what the language actually is, that's a legitimate name. You know, as they refer to it over and over again, that's the name of the Doctor as you see it in Gallifreyan. That's what it is, and you'll see that exact pattern used over and over and over. But as for the individual sort of icons or compound characters that you see across the rotor there, no, I'm not seeing it. Prove me wrong, though, please. Somebody out there.
Yeah, if someone has a translation out there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Go for it. Yeah, put Picasso to work and have it solve the images.
That's about it. I think we've actually run a little bit longer tonight than we typically do. So
I like it when you can have more than an hour discussion for an hour show.
Yeah, for 40 minutes worth of show. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
So do you guys have anything to say in closing?
No. I think I've thrown my monkey wrenches out there. I've played my devil's advocate, and I've thrown my goofball theories. I'm spent.
Yeah, so people need to, you know, if you have any counter goofball theories, let us know, because now suddenly people are listening to this and talking to us and interacting, and we love everyone's thoughts and suggestions. So let's just talk about that right now. If you want to email us, you can find us at gallifreypublicradio.com. Our email is feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Leave comments on iTunes. Use the at Gallifrey Public Radio Twitter.
You can get the rundown of how to reach all of us at Gallifrey Public Radio. There's an About Us section right there on the site that gives you the direct contact to each of us if you want to attack us individually or hoist us up on your shoulders for saying, boy, are you good at calling it.
Man. Some people's heads are a little too heavy to hoist on your shoulders, though, so we understand.
Exactly. So I'm going to need a couple of extra minions to hold up my cranium.
But yeah, thank you to everyone for the feedback you've been giving us. I mean, it's really great. We love this stuff. We really do thrive on it. So please keep it coming. We love hearing from you guys and hearing the stuff that we never would have thought of aside from Kier, because he knows everything that's going to happen for the next 3 years in the show.
But I can't remember him for more than about 10 minutes. So I can predict it. And then once it happens, it's gone. It's out of my head.
I think that's the silence.
Is that it? Yeah. Where did the Sharpie come from?
All right. Well, this has been episode 32 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying I'm off to rename my whole network. How do you get those symbols?
And this is Melissa saying, what part of anti-grav didn't you understand?
And this is Kier saying, I told you so. I told you so. I told you so.
See you guys next week.
Good night, everybody. How's he?
Joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review, send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, on Stitcher Smart Radio, or at our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.
Which one was that?
Yeah, I got its whole text from you that was like dashes and dots, but it looked like a fucking...
It was the whole pew, pew, pew.
Okay. I don't remember doing that one, but okay.
Well, you did, and it was epic.
That's like when someone shows you their baby and they have a really, really ugly baby, but they love their baby so much. you have to say something. So you're like, oh, look at that.
That is a baby.
That's a baby.